supposed to be related to Magnitsky Bill and
Yes.
uneasiness between Russia and the United States. What do you think about? Is there going to be really something big related to this bill, or?
Well, I think the right reaction on the part of Russia would be to pass a bill which would require the Russian Foreign Office to maintain a public list of human rights abusers in the United States and to freeze their assets. They could begin with President Obama, who's a major human rights violator. He's directing a global assassination campaign, which is a major atrocity. I mean, if Russia were doing anything like that, we'd, you know, people would be talking about having a nuclear war. And then you can go on from there. So, for example, the U.S. Is strongly supporting, in fact, participating in terrible human rights abuses in Gaza just a couple of weeks ago again, and they can go around the world. So the United States is providing huge amounts of armaments to Saudi Arabia, which is one of the worst human rights abusers in the world, and you can go on from there. So that would be the right reaction. Of course, they're not going to do it.
But do you think that generally that's going to really bring some uneasiness from now on related Russia-United States relations, or it's just going to be a piece of paper?
Well, that depends on how the how the matter is handled. If it's just regarded as a symbolic gesture with no consequences, well, then it'll just be a nuisance. On the other hand, if it influences policy, it could be more than that. The idea that the United States would do something like that, given its shocking human rights record right at the moment, is takes a lot of gall, actually. Of course, that's not understood in the United States. The media don't talk about it. If I refer to President Obama as one of the leading human rights violators in the world, although it's true, if I said that in an interview with the New York Times, they would know what I'm talking about.
The next question is related to Syria. NATO approved the deployment of Patriot missile interceptors to defend Turkey's border with Syria. What do you think? What is next going to happen?
I don't think anybody knows. Syria is moving towards kind of suicide, and they're... It doesn't seem to be any easy way out. Just this morning, got even worse, as you may have seen. There was a battle yesterday between Kurdish and rebel forces. That adds a new complexity to the situation, which, of course, is very, very much affects Turkey. Turkey is quite worried, naturally, about the rise of a Kurdish autonomy region in Syria and what it might, how it might affect the huge Kurdish problem within Turkey. But inside Syria, it just looks like a growing horror story with no real feasible solution in sight. There are various proposals. There's another one coming along today discussions, I believe, in Dublin with Lakhdar Brahimi and representatives of Russia and the United States, but it's going to be extremely difficult to find a way out of this without just destruction of the country. The Assad regime, Assad himself, is facing assassination no matter what happens. I mean, if he agrees to leave the country, he would probably be killed by his Alawite associates because he's abandoning them to whatever fate would happen. If he doesn't leave the country, sooner or later they'll be wiped out. And unless somebody can figure out a way to, I mean, there have been proposals. Just a couple of days ago, there was a proposal by one Syria specialist, Nicholas Noy, that there be temporarily some kind of partition in which a region around Damascus is left under Assad's control and the rest of the country's left under rebel control, and see if there can be a, work out some modus vivendi in which there could be a reduction of violence and maybe a negotiated settlement. But that's a long shot, and I haven't really heard any other good proposal. And another problem that's arising is the chemical weapons problem. Syria has already crossed what Obama called his red line on chemical weapons. The U.S. has backed off and moved the red line a little backwards, but sooner or later that's going to be a huge problem, and nobody has an answer to it. You can't bomb them.
I mean, I'm from Serbia originally. I was born in Belgrade, and the situation in Syria really resembles to the what we had in ex-Yugoslavia. First, some civic unrest, and then it became a really like a big war, and then we had bombing on Kosovo. So that's why I'm asking, because this is really very much alike.
Well, I don't see. I mean, we could talk about Kosovo, but I think that's a different situation. I think that's very much misrepresented in the West.
Could you tell us something about what do you think about Obama's re-election? What does it mean to Russia, especially related to the USA missile defense system, which is about to be assembled in Europe, or at least we think it's going to be assembled?
Well, I mean, first of all, it's worth bearing in mind that on all sides, it is understood by strategic analysts and presumably by political leaders that a missile defense system is a first strike weapon. Missile defense systems, even if they work, and that's a question, but to the extent that they work, they're not going to be able to stop a first strike. Conceivably, they could prevent a retaliatory strike, which means that they're effectively a first-strike weapon. And, of course, Russia knows this, American planners knows this, and so on. So placing a missile system on near Russia's borders, which is what's planned, is a highly provocative act. If Russia was to try to do that in Canada, let's say, we just go to war. It wouldn't be even remotely tolerated. Whether Obama he has made some slight adjustments in the plans for a missile system under Bush, but they still leave the system in a form which the Russian military, Russian strategic analysts have to interpret as highly threatening, just as the U.S. would if Russia was doing anything similar. Now, a couple of months ago, you'll recall, off camera, Obama made some comments.
Yes.
Hinting that maybe he'd back off on it after the election. That became a big issue here, because it was caught. But whether he'll do anything like that, I doubt very much.
Could we talk a little bit about the Hague Tribunal? So, two Croatian generals convicted of the killing of ethnic Serbs in the 90s have been acquitted at the Hague. And then 10 days later, also Ramush Haradinaj, one of the ex-KLA leader, was also acquitted of all charges. How do you comment this?
Well, it's very hard to take the Hague Tribunal seriously from the beginning. So go back to Kosovo again. There was an international tribunal, and Louise Arbour, who was then in charge of it, was approached by Western lawyers, in fact, with the proposal to investigate NATO crimes, NATO bombing. And she said that NATO would not be subject to investigation by the tribunal. All right, that tells us right off it's not a serious tribunal.
Yes.
It's and everything that's followed from that is pretty predictable.
It's not
serious?
I mean,
there were efforts to do something. Like her successor did talk about investigating KLA atrocities, charges of organ removal and so on, but that was quickly quashed.
Exactly. The problem is that we can't really consider the Hague Tribunal as a serious one, but still many Serbian leaders got life detention. So it seems like there is really no justice, or this is really not...
But, you know, this goes far back. I mean, probably the most... of all the tribunals, I think the most serious and reputable one was the Nuremberg Tribunal, you know, the first modern tribunal.
Yes.
But if you look at it, it was deeply flawed, and that was understood by the prosecutors. So the principles of the Nuremberg Tribunal, what they came down to is if you committed a crime and we didn't commit the same crime, then it's a crime. So, for example, saturation bombing of urban civilian concentrations was not considered a crime at Nuremberg because the Allies did it more than the Germans did. German Admiral Dönitz, a submarine commander, in his defense at Nuremberg, he brought an American admiral, Admiral Nimitz, and representative of the British Admiralty, who testified that Britain and the United States carried out the same crimes that he was accused of. And that was considered by the tribunal sufficient to absolve him of those charges. He was charged on other things. So altogether, the tribunal, morally speaking, was very deeply flawed for these reasons. It's still, that was, I think, the most serious of the tribunals that have been established.
I understand your thesis and your point of view, but still, since I'm from Serbia, it's really difficult to comprehend that we as a nation, as a state, that we're going to have a kind of guilt for from now on till who knows when, but seems like it's going to happen, and the history is already somewhere written, and that we can't really change it, although I can't say that we are really guilty as much as international community says that we are. And your expectations for the next year related to world economic or financial crisis, the crisis in European Union, and generally, what do you think, what's going to happen in international relations, Russia-United States relations, China-United States relations?
Well, that's too many questions to try to answer. There's lots of things are uncertain. Let's begin with the financial crisis. The financial crisis is created by what has been called a doom loop by one of the directors of the British Bank, charge of banking stability. It's a doom loop because there's a system in which in the United States and Britain and to some extent elsewhere, in which the big investment firms are essentially encouraged to undertake risky transactions in which they can make a lot of profit because they're risky, and they will sooner or later collapse because of the risk. And at that point, the taxpayer comes in and bails them out. That's a doom loop. There's a government insurance policy for the big banks. The name for it in the United States is too big to fail. So we've got to bail them out when they get into trouble. It's essentially a government insurance policy. It amounts, it's roughly estimated on the order of about $50 billion a year for the big banks, gives them higher credit ratings and so on. The credit agencies take that into account when they rate them, that they're going to be bailed out by taxpayers if anything goes wrong. All of that is just encouragement to continue a cycle of risky transactions, profits, collapse, bailout. It's been going on since the early Reagan years. By that time, the regulatory apparatus of the New Deal was being dismantled, so this was encouraged. Now, there is legislation in the United States, the Dodd-Frank bill, which is supposed to put some restrictions on this, but it's quite unclear, first of all, how much of the Dodd-Frank bill will survive the huge efforts of lobbyists right now to cut away at it so that it's not going to really apply very well. And even to the extent it does apply, it leaves many of the problems untouched. So chances are we're building up to another and probably bigger financial crisis. Meanwhile, in Europe, the Troika, European
funds.
Yeah, we know who they are. They're carrying out policies which are almost bound to be an economic disaster, imposing austerity during a time of recession is economic, just from a purely economic point of view, makes no sense. Say for Greece, it just increases the debt. It cuts back growth, so there's no way out of it. The countries that are Spain and Greece particularly, they do not have control of their own currencies, so they can't do what let's say the United States or any country that prints its own money could do. They can't reduce the value of their currency and grow their way out of it. They can't do that. They're using the euro. So they're trapped. Austerity will make the situation worse. It's particularly, Greece, there's plenty of internal problems, but it's particularly striking in the case of Spain, because before the collapse of the financial system, which is not the fault of the government, that's the fault of the banks, the Spanish banks, and including the German banks, which are doing the lending. Before this collapse, 2007, the Spanish state budget was in quite good shape. And in fact, Spain has some of the lowest expenditures in Europe for social services and so on. It's not a matter of government expenditures. It's a banking problem, and that's getting worse. Even the business press and the financial press is criticizing this. In fact, the IMF has begun to back off from these policies because it's so obvious where they lead economically. About the only, and it's worth remembering that the European Central Bank is much more reactionary than its U.S. counterpart, the Fed, the Federal Reserve. The Federal Reserve has a double mandate. One mandate is to control inflation, and there's not a hint of inflation in sight. The other mandate is to maintain full employment. Of course, it doesn't do much about that, but at least to make some gestures. The European Central Bank has only the first mandate, control inflation. And it has to control it at an artificially low level, 2%, that's imposed by the Bundesbank, which is very harmful to the economy, and it means there's no mandate at all to do something about employment. So its policies have actually been worse than those of the U.S. Federal Reserve, the counterpart in the United States. And it's showing in Europe. One of the consequences of it was actually described by the president of the ECB, Mario Draghi. He had an interview in the Wall Street Journal in which he said the social contract in Europe is unsustainable, it's dead, we have to give up on the welfare state. From the point of view of elite and wealthy sectors, it's fine with them. They never liked the welfare state, and if it's dismantled,
but when it comes
too
to
bad. And that's where Europe is going, unless there's a big change. As far as international relations are concerned, there's quite a lot to say. China, the U.S., U.S.-China relations are complex. China's plainly, economically, China's a growing power, though I think people underestimate the internal problems it has to maintain its growth. And there's a security conflict. It's called in the U.S. You know, professional literature, it's called a classic security dilemma. The United States wants, China wants to gain control over the waters nearby China, which it uses for where most of its trade is, and the U.S. also wants to control the waters nearby China, so there's a conflict. And other states in the region also have their own conflicts with China about who will control, say, the South China Sea and so on. So there's plenty of problems. How they'll be resolved, we don't know.
Problem with Japanese islands, is it
they're called in the West they're called Japanese islands.
But they're Chinese.
The Chinese call them Chinese islands. And in fact, if you look at the history, Japan doesn't have much of a claim to them.
Do you think that's the part of the problem? It belongs
That's part of the problem.
Okay. Mm-hmm. And what do you think about Russia-United States relations, how it's going to develop?
Well, we've already talked a little about that. I mean, Russia's got plenty of internal problems, and how it's going to handle these is not at all clear. There's the direct conflicts between Russia and the United States may not be as sharp as potentially between the U.S. and China. On the other hand, in the case of China, China and the U.S. have a huge trading relation. In fact, China holds a substantial part of U.S. debt, about as little more than Japan. And of course, the United States is the main consumer of China. U.S. and Europe are the main consumers of Chinese goods. In the case of Russia, that's much less so. It's only energy export, so it's quite a different relationship. I'm afraid I have to go. There's another interview waiting.
Professor Chomsky, thank you very much for your time and the interview.
Yeah.
Yes.
Okay. Yeah.
Wish you all the best. Goodbye.
Thank you.